everyone. Welcome to another episode of Leg Upward Inclusion Spotlight, Making the Invisible Visible, with me, Dr. Aparajita Jirigunta. Today's guest, actually, I have to thank from the bottom of my heart because it is currently 6:30 a.m. on the West Coast, and today's guest made time to have this conversation with me because he's just so awesome, and he's also a fellow NLC alum, and so it is with great pleasure that today I want to have a conversation with Jake Tunkel. Jake Tunkel is a candidate for San Jose City Council and a senior biomedical engineer with Reline Corporation. He attended Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, I messed that one up, so RPI, where he earned his BS in mechanical engineering and his minor in sustainability studies. His classes on environmental sociology and being raised by a mother with a background in women's studies helped him discover a passion for environmental and social justice. After graduating from college, Jake worked for a non-invasive heart valve company before taking off to Morocco for 2 years to volunteer with the Peace Corps. There, Jake learned Arabic and worked in a youth center developing environmental initiatives and teaching chess and English. Jake also helped to lead Columbia University Engineers Without Borders students through the technical and cultural challenges of two rural engineering projects, an access bridge and a well water system. He has been active in organizing anti-war protests, discussion panels on divestment, and developing community outreach strategies. Hi, Jake.
Hello.
You know, you have such an impressive bio and you have such an impressive list of accomplishments because in addition to your bio, there's so many other things that I could touch on. But it seems like the common thread in all of this in your life right now is public service. And so for our listeners, you know, what I'm curious about is when and where did this passion in public service develop and why?
Well, I don't really have a good pinpoint on where or when. Just growing up, all of it kind of came together to almost the point where I moved home after finishing, you know, my two plus years in the Peace Corps and realized that the most impactful way that I could, you know, do work for my community and move things forward was getting involved in local government, whether it was attending community meetings, attending, you know, city council meetings, meetings for the Board of Supervisors. And as I began to do that over the last, you know, three and a half years now, really focused locally, I realized that to be able to do that took a lot of privilege. I had to be able to leave work in the afternoon. I had to be able to come back to work afterwards, be able to go from work downtown. All of that costs money. It costs time. But the diversity of people that could show up in these spaces was very limited. It was something I thought that I could help get involved in and move forward because we can't build a community together if not everybody's there.
That's really interesting, the idea of privilege in public service. I guess every person that I know in public office is in that space only in that capacity. So it's very interesting that on the local level, you know, you have people like you who are doing 9-to-5 jobs and then also serving or also trying to go for public office and being able to serve publicly. How do you balance the professional career side of it and this public service side, which is another career, essentially?
It does feel that way at the moment. And I can't say that I've figured it out. I've had conversations with, you know, the CEO of our company and my family, you know, members in the community that I work with, and there's never really a great way to balance it. It feels like all of us are spread really thin. And that connects me back to everything that I'm trying to do, actually, by figuring out new ways to bring voices to the table. Because if I'm that stressed and that busy and I have a job that pays well and is flexible and it's still nearly impossible to balance it all out, I can't imagine, you know, having to raise kids at the same time or, you know, especially being a single parent, someone that's, you know, less well off financially or dealing with so many other issues that I have the privilege to not have to worry about at the moment. And it keeps me motivated and keeps me going. So I do stay pretty busy, but my calendar definitely helps.
It definitely sounds like it. I want to take a very short break. And when we come back, we are going to continue talking about how this public service passion developed through NLC. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this break. And we're back on Leg Upward Inclusion Spotlight, Making the Invisible Visible. And today's guest with us is Jake Tunkel, who is a candidate for San Jose City Council. And Jake is also a 2019 fellow from the Silicon Valley chapter of the New Leaders Council. And that is actually how Jake and I met at the national convention. And, you know, I just thought he was just such an intriguing person and just so involved. I'm really glad we're having this conversation on this segment now, Jake. Tell me more about how your ideas for running for candidate for San Jose City Council and NLC, how all of those align to create this, you know, I guess to me, it seems like a beautiful space.
Well, thank you. It's fairly interesting. So the way that I had been involved in my community since moving back from Morocco, everything seemed really small. There's a couple of organizations, whether it's San Jose Peace and Justice Center or people doing work in divestment, so very environmentally focused for the most part. That was my network. And what NLC gave me the opportunity to do was to branch out in a way that got me involved with people that were doing amazing work in labor, you know, for undocumented population, in inclusion and outreach and diversity and nonprofit and, you know, socially responsible businesses. And they threw us all into a room, gave us a little bit of direction. How do we work together to, you know, move society to a place that I think we would all be much happier and safer and in a more loving space. Gave us a couple of presentations to teach us how people have done it in the past and then let us figure out what are we going to do to change things. And NLC has a focus around local politics, around national politics and running for office. So there was a lot of training came with that that really highlighted while you have, there are people that have certain skills around social media or voter outreach, that having a community behind you that touches on so many diverse aspects of what being a local elected official means and being able to represent people that aren't just the identity that you identify with means you have to understand and know and have friends that are doing all of this work. And that's what NLC was really able to give me to make it seem feasible, to make it seem like running for office was the appropriate way that I could take the activism and the community organizing that I was doing and maybe turn it up.
Yeah, I can see the alignment in terms of how it's that energy of that room, isn't it? It's the energy of the cohort.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's how this entire podcast and everything got started as well, from that same energy. So I completely get it. I want to talk about one thing in particular within your NLC experience, and that's your recent work within the public banking movement for California Assembly Bill 857. Now, is that what your Spark Talk was about?
Correct. So I was extremely fortunate to give a Spark Talk at NLC's national convention, and there were amazing conversations that I had because of that. And there were amazing other Spark Talks, you know, Aparajita, you had yours as well. They were all so inspiring. Why AB 857 connected a lot of things for me locally. It was my first time doing direct law. I had always, you know, attended or organized protests, very much more on the outskirts of the political sphere. And through NLC, I was able to build connections that helped me get into the offices of local elected officials. To push for this concept of public banking, for listeners that don't know or haven't really heard, the public banking concept is the idea that our local government, whether it be a county, a city, a state, have a financial institution that they run themselves so that they're not taking our tax dollars and putting them in perhaps a really large, you know, Wall Street bank where we have no say in what those tax dollars are used for. Right? Coming out of the divestment movement, out of, you know, Standing Rock movement, where Wells Fargo was a major investor in the Dakota Access Pipeline, we had no control. And when people have the ability to move their individual money, that's great. Not all of us are extremely wealthy, and so the impact is a bit lower. But the billions in tax dollars that are available from cities that get given to banks like Wells Fargo or Bank of America, if we can change how those are invested, we have a real strong impact, and we send a real strong message. Where it gets exciting is that the public banking movement isn't just about divesting, but it's about investing as well. On a local level, being being at many city council meetings, you know, to commission meetings, a lot of what we want to do to build our community up costs money. And so someone will always be there in the room to say, yeah, but how are you going to pay for that? And on things like affordable housing or, you know, climate mitigation infrastructure, there's plenty of economic research out there that shows that those have a positive economic benefit for our community, meaning they're good investment. They're just slower. They don't have a Wall Street profit maximizing return. And so we don't always have the opportunity to pick. Well, we know between two projects, one that is extremely profitable and one that has untold community benefits, but is less profitable. And so the market's always going to choose one way or the other, and it's always going to go for the maximum return.
You know, I can see how from the one end divestment can just turn into like some beautiful investment in the long term. And for me, it's that unquantifiable aspect of community building and goodwill. That's the X factor that I think, at least for me personally, takes over just the profit margin aspect of it. So I think this is a beautiful plan.
We're excited about it. It's going to take quite a few years, but we have a lot of models to go off of and bounce off of. So for anyone that hasn't heard of this, we actually have a public bank in the United States, Bank of North Dakota. And it's been around 100 years as of like last month. But additionally, it's all over the world. I think like 40% back in 2005 or so of the world's, you know, banking finances were in publicly owned banks, whether they were nationally or locally owned. So countries as India, China, Brazil, Russia, even Germany, they all kind of use this model because we don't want to go searching into a private sector for investment in public good, or an investment in our community, because you're never going to get the best deal. Someone on the other end always has the justification to make the most profit. And in a lot of, you know, those of us that are working in this movement, we see that this is an opportunity to change that discussion, but we do have to be involved. So one of the, you know, caveats I want to make sure we bring up is that the Bank of North Dakota actually helped fund the expansion of the police force that came to brutalize protesters.
Wow.
And so unfortunately, what a public bank isn't this amazing, you know, solution that is going to make everyone in the community come together and finally be able to do everything they want to do. It's just a tool. And so the community engagement and the democratic process that determines what that bank does, who sits on the board, you know, who's making the decisions, what's in the bylaws or what's in the charter, that has to have the diversity and the inclusion that we need to actually make responsible decisions. Otherwise, it's just like so many other things that can be corrupted and used for continued expansion of colonialism and other negative aspects that have come out of this for-profit capitalistic system that we have.
Definitely. And, you know, actually, that's a perfect segue into our next segment, you know, because as you know me, like, you know, the little bit that we know each other, my whole thing is that diversity and inclusion piece. So we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get into the heart of the matter that lights up my inner fire, what your experience in the D&I space has been. So we'll be right back. Hang on. And we're back on Leg Upward Inclusion Spotlight, making the invisible visible. And my guest today is Jake Tonkel, who is having this chat with me before 7 a.m. from California time. So, and I just have to keep saying that because it's mind blowing to me. But, you know, we've had this great conversation about how you got into this idea of public service, Jake, and how NLC sort of aligned with that beautifully. And then we started talking about banking and the really crucial need for intentional diversity and inclusion in the public banking space. So tell me more about the role that you see banking and this public banking playing in building up the inclusive efforts in your space.
Yeah, so one of the, you know, kind of, I guess there are tidbit facts and anecdotes in a way that is important to know in the banking industry because they're representative of systematic oppression and injustices. It's just how little diversity we have in our banking and finance system. You know, one of the things that I'll say in presentations is that so often our small business loans go to men and don't go to women. Or so often, you know, I think it's people of color are 2x, you know, two times as likely to be rejected for a home loan while they meet the same economic criteria. And that's because the people making the decisions generally tend to be older, you know, white men. And they don't understand their internalized racism. They don't understand their internalized sexism. And when you have a private sphere like you do in banking, it takes good reporters years, decades to dig through documents, to request things that aren't public record so that we can figure out and pinpoint what it is that we still haven't corrected in a banking system that decades ago was engaged in redlining to make sure that communities of color could not own their homes and build equity and get into a more financially stable space. And we're still not there today. So being able to build a bank from the ground up that is focused and has responsibility to everyone in that community, citizen or non-citizen, white or person of color, is extremely important. So setting a board of directors that is diverse, that has new ways of thinking and people that are going to purvey that process and hopefully that inclusivity into what the bank actually does. Focusing on, you know, person of color loans for small businesses or affordable housing, which we know helps so many different communities, single moms, et cetera, that it's extremely important that we figure out strong mechanisms so that we don't fall back into what the traditional banking and finance system has done.
I agree. And a part of me also wants to say that you do have this perspective because you spent 27 months, you know, 3 hours outside of Marrakesh in Morocco as a Peace Corps volunteer. And then you also mentioned you travel a lot to China. And you said, I forget the other places you said. I know you recently were in China. How has all of your, in what ways? I mean, I already know it has, but in what ways has all of this sort of international travel helped you understand what's going on with inclusion in our country better?
That's an interesting point. And it's still a learning process for me, just like it is for all of us. I think being able to say that is also helpful because it motivates me to continue to learn. But what international development had, you know, in the last decade or so is kind of a really strong split in models of development. And so on one hand, you have I'm trying to think of a good example because I know the Gates Foundation has been doing a lot better, but organizations that will come in with material items or Western thought processes and say, this is what we see lacking in your community. Here you go. You can have it. Mm. You know, whether it's, you know, healthcare or technology, education, the Western world goes around and many of these, you know, NGOs, non-governmental organizations will say, this is what we think you need. We're going to be, you know, good Samaritans and give it to you. And then oftentimes all those resources, they don't match the cultural fabric. They don't match the diversity of the place that they're going into, and they get wasted. And so what I really valued about my Peace Corps experience was being on the other end of this development model. You know, I wasn't there for a 6-week trip. I wasn't there for 3 months. I was there for 27 months. And the focus was learn about your community so that you can help them get to different resources that they are lacking because they know how to build their community. They are the best people to move things forward. How do you streamline that process to people of privilege? How do we go back to the United States and work on policy or in NGOs that can then go and continue that work to provide what many of these countries are lacking is just resources. And so I even get into my own internal conflict. You know, there's a lot of great articles that talk about how we should just stop programs like the Peace Corps in a way where we're sending people that don't know about the culture to the culture, having them take pictures and, you know, not being as effective as if that plane ticket and all of those resources involved went directly to the community because they know what to do best. And usually it's unfortunately a lack of resources that keeps them where they are. And so where I could come out of this and in a way justify, you know, my experience was how do I continue to speak to that and teach people about that aspect of development where our community, either locally as an elected official, hopefully future elected official here in San Jose, our community knows what it needs, just like all of these other communities around the globe. They know what they need to move forward, but usually the people in power are the ones that think they know best and they push solutions onto that community. That's what I'm hoping to be able to tie in from my Peace Corps experience to this. And I can't do that unless I have amazing people around me that are focused on this diversity and inclusion aspect in every way, whether it's private, nonprofit, or governmental sector.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's so interesting that you brought up that idea of resources and the cultural fabric, because it always takes me, you know, whenever I think about that particular issue, it always takes me back to The last time I visited India, we had the chance to go to this really small town, and there was a small school in a small town, and it was so proud that it had a computer lab.
Yeah.
And I was amazed. It blew my mind. Right? Because, I mean, of course, like India being like, you know, a huge part of the tech corridor and everything, that was great. But to go to a more rural place and see this, I thought, oh, that's great. And then I looked around and I said, where are your electrical lines? And they said they run the computers on a generator, like maybe about once or twice a week.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, for me, everything you're talking about just resonates so well when I think about that story, because it's like, okay, somebody gave them an entire computer lab and they don't have electricity.
Yeah, and that context is so often missed when you're not in the community for years beforehand. And sometimes it works out. You know, I know there's an organization that is giving computers to indigenous tribes in the Amazon, but the reasoning is that you will use this to contact people when someone illegally deforests on your land as a communication mechanism. So it serves a specific purpose, has a similar technological look. We're going into two communities and providing a computer and perhaps access to the internet, but they serve very different purposes and could be effective in one and ineffective in the other.
Yes, I think that actually brings me to a very interesting point that you mentioned in the response you gave to me is, you know, I asked you, how can we do better with making the invisible visible? And you, your entire answer, there's no doubt that you believe education is the best way forward. And I hear a lot of that in sort of when you're talking about bringing in the people that know the community and letting the community make its decisions on what it needs. It does sound like there's a lot of educational components to what you're thinking too. Tell me more about that, please.
Of course. As a community organizer, as an activist, so many of our global struggles, you know, collectively are still making their way into people's consciousness at least here in the United States, in a wealthier area, you know, like Silicon Valley. And what I hear the most often when I talk about public banking or, you know, some other local issue, diversity and inclusion is, well, I didn't know, right? Now that I know, we should start our, you know, spaces out with our gender pronouns. You know, my name is Jake Tonkel, and identify he, him, that we create a space where someone else is able to give us more information than we had before, or hopefully feels comfortable giving more than we had before. And as that becomes more and more main focus in the beginning of any community meeting or any organization that we have, we're educating. We're saying this has been a problem that didn't just, you know, happen today, but now that it's in the discussion point, we can make very real decisions on how to run our meetings that are more inclusive. I have to, you know, thank one of my good friends, Michelle Mashburn. She's the director at the San Jose Peace and Justice Center, and she has been amazingly helpful in bringing that educational aspect to me. You know, we were just at a meeting at City Hall where she pointed out that the presentation didn't meet universal design standards. The font was too small and colors weren't differentiated enough so that presentation could be effective and well understood by everyone in the audience. And so often I find myself, you know, just, all right, I'm going to create this flyer. I think it looks good to me. You know, I'm going to create this PowerPoint. It seems readable. And we run. You know, everybody's pressed for time and stressed. And who knows, you know, there's 1,000 other things to go into it. But until you have someone educating you, there is a better way to do this where you're going to get a better response from the community, where you're going to be able to get your information out there to more people. And to people that have a diverse viewpoint, that's our goal. And if we're ever going to reach it, people have to be comfortable being told if that PowerPoint is terrible, right? You need to fix it. So I absolutely value that.
So as we wrap up, what would you like to tell my listeners and any listeners out there in your space, my space, what would you like to tell them about your campaign for city council and, you know, anything else? Like what is sort of your take home message for this particular conversation?
I appreciate the opportunity. I'm not the greatest at short little self plugs, but the reason why a major motivating factor for me in running for local office here in San Jose was environmental justice. So we came out as a city, you know, they did a lot of work on what's called the Climate Smart San Jose Plan. And it's this really detailed economic and environmental analysis on how we meet a Paris Climate Accord CO2 emission goal and what it looks like for us locally, because that's where we have an impact, right? But what I didn't see in that report was really any strong understanding of environmental justice and inequity, because it threw out billions of dollars in a space. It didn't throw it out, like it explaining that you need billions of dollars in this area in the public or the private sector through individuals, which means households, need billions of dollars on their own to be able to put solar on their houses or do drought-tolerant landscaping, reduce their carbon footprint by living closer to where they work, all of those things that we need to do if we're ever going to solve a climate crisis on a global scale. It put that on the backs of the community that can't afford it without understanding we have an airport and the people that live closest to the airport have, you know, air quality issues and, you know, health issues that are around that. Because the lens was so focused on here's our problem, here's our solution, but we can't have everyone with solar and a Tesla. Right? We're not going to solve this problem that way. And I get a lot of heat from different community organizations. It tends to be more older gentlemen that addressing climate change is something that national governments will get together and do. And I absolutely disagree that understanding the connection between economic inequality, healthcare, the environment, education, that the way that those fit together and who they come to meet are community members and individuals and the first layer of elected representatives that have the biggest impact, honestly, on someone's day-to-day life is local government. And that's what inspired me to decide to run for office in a time where people are hurting everywhere. And we're very fortunate here in Silicon Valley. There's a lot of wealth, but it's also got a lot of income, you know, disparity for very poor families living in their cars or on the street next to billionaires and millionaires. And it's not healthy. It doesn't create a safe space for everyone. And it's just wrong. And so I thought that running for office, I could create some policy, maybe like a public bank or some other creative ideas that I think, if you visit my website, jake4d6.com. That's Jake, the number 4, D, the letter, and then 6, the number, .com, that there are some new things that I've learned just from traveling, tying this back to, you know, going to China or Morocco or, you know, spending time, you know, in Europe. What do other countries do that are successful on a local level? What is Suzhou, where I go in China, doing? What is, you know, Berlin doing to address their affordable housing? Right? What is the city of Portland doing to reduce income inequality? They have a very cool, and I'm rambling on here, but they were able to get a tax on corporations that pay their executives more than 100 times their median employee. You don't have to have the same conversation of, well, raising the minimum wage loses jobs and gains jobs and hurts people and helps people, because as much as there is data out there to show that it's probably a good idea, not everyone believes it that way. But if we can make sure that companies that are doing well bring their employees up with them, and smaller businesses that maybe there is some justification for them struggling and not being able to afford to pay everyone, you know, a better wage, that we can have that conversation in a different light, and it brings in other new ideas as well. And so I'm excited to be able to.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I think that's one of the really great things about being a part of the progressive space that you and I had the privilege to be a part of at National Convention, is sort of seeing a lot of these ideas on a national level, but being applied in so many different ways, which then really allows us to be creative within our own spaces by learning about how it's being done in all of these different spaces and what's working and what's not, and then bringing it back to our community and our issues and our passions and seeing what we can do with it. And so it sounds to me, at least, like, you know, that there is a lot of that happening where you're just really looking at local, regional, national, global case studies of this, and you're just really kind of taking them apart and saying, okay, what worked here? What did not work here? Why? And how would that apply to anything that I'm going to try to do now? I personally think that's a fantastic way to go and a fantastic thought to develop, but, you know, I have my education background, so maybe I'm biased. Thank you again, Jake, so much.
Thank you so much for having me. me.
I would love to have you back for another conversation soon, Jake. I have so many more questions.
I would really appreciate it.
For our listeners, I will put all of Jake's contact information on the podcast description, so you'll be able to follow him on Instagram and follow the campaign on the website. Support him however you can. Check him out. Learn more about what he wants to do. And join the cause. Join the efforts. We will be back with another episode of Leg Upward Inclusion Spotlight, Making the Invisible Visible. Until then, I hope everyone has a lovely time and thinks about how they can make the invisible in their lives visible.